This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening, and thank you for coming this evening to hear Philip Levine read from his poetry. My name is Kate Daniels, and I'm extremely pleased and honored to have been asked by the Lannan Foundation to introduce Philip Levine to you. Philip Levine is probably one of the most written about poets of our time. He's been a prolific writer of poetry and prose, a generous interviewee, a well-liked and highly popular teacher and reader of poetry. And all of these have combined with the excellence and uniqueness of his work to create really a stunningly thorough body of critical commentary. So it's very likely, I suspect, that some of you may already be familiar or even very familiar with the basic details of his life and work. Nevertheless, I'm going to summarize those briefly for you and then speak a little bit more specifically about a couple of issues related to his poetry. Levine was born in Detroit, a city that has become, of course, iconically identified with his work, in 1928, into a family of Russian Jewish immigrants. His father died when he was only 5 years old, leaving his mother to raise him and his two brothers. After his education in the Detroit public schools, Levine entered night school at what was then called Wayne University. We know it today as Wayne State University, working a variety of manual labor jobs during the day. Many of his most famous poems appear to have originated in this period of his life, documenting a time during which the young poet struggled to claim and establish a poetic identity for himself. In these poems, we see him ruminating upon how his evolution out of the working class into which he was born might be achieved without relinquishing his connections with the family, friends, and community whose fate as working class people was to be so different ultimately from his own. Levine received both a bachelor's and a master's degree from Wayne State. He wrote his master's degree on John Keats's Ode to Indolence. During the 1950s, he enrolled in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where he studied with both Robert Lowell and John Berryman. He married and became a father. He began to publish his poems. In 1957 and 58, he was a Jones Fellow in Creative Writing at Stanford University, where he studied with Ivor Winners. And in 1958, he accepted a teaching position at the California State University at Fresno, where he taught until the late 1990s. He and his wife, Fran, have 3 sons and 5 grandchildren. They split their time between their homes in Fresno and Brooklyn, where Levine teaches each fall in the graduate creative writing program at New York University. Philip Levine is the author of almost 20 volumes of poetry and several volumes of prose. Among them are certainly some titles that you all will recognize. They Feed, They Lion, 1933, The Names of the Lost, Ashes, Seven Years from Somewhere, One for the Rose, Sweet Will, A Walk with Tom Jefferson, What Work Is, The Simple Truth, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1995, and The Mercy. His many, many honors for writing include, besides the Pulitzer, the National Book Award, the American Book Award, several National Book Critics Circles Awards, 2 Guggenheim Fellowships, 3 National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. He is a Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, as well as the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I'm pleased as well and proud to say that he and his work will be honored on next month on the occasion of his 75th birthday with a 2-day poetry colloquium at Vanderbilt University, where I teach, and where Phil was writer in residence in the spring of 1995 when he received the Pulitzer Prize. One of the things that is most appealing to me as both a reader and a fellow poet about Levine's work is its emotional intensity. Although that intensity focuses on any number of subjects, what I want to say a few words about here is his obsession, and that is not too strong a word, I think, his obsession with the role of loss and imagination in our lives. It is only imagination in Levine's world that staunches the hemorrhaging wounds of linear time and human mortality. Thus, he is a poet of the ordinary details and quotidian moments by which we recognize our lives, but for which, too often, we fail to praise them. Boiled potatoes, a cut of salami, parking lots, bus stations, engine blocks, lunch boxes, burlap bags, suburban houses where an early riser sits alone in the kitchen drinking coffee while the children still sleep. Levine has made a life work of poetry from such. Taken together, momentary details and passing moments like these cohere to identify and organize each of our unique and specific human lives. These were not the labors of Hercules, he says in Salts and Oils. These were not of meat or moment to anyone but me. The necessary loss of our personal details and private moments in the flow of time is unbearably painful, as we all know. Levine has focused his poetic eye precisely here at what we might call the starting point of elegy. And yet, though there are elegiac moments in many of his poems, his poetry ultimately resists that classification. For his task is neither to mourn nor to enshrine the past, but to use it as a kind of motor, a metaphor that seems peculiarly apt for a poet born in Detroit, but to use it as a kind of motor, if you will, dynamizing and transforming all that has been lost into an active agent, useful to us in our present lives. In a marvelous poem called Lost and Found from his collection Ashes, we hear his memorable description of this, of what might be called both philosophy and process in his work. This is the end of the poem. The night that seemed so final had ended, and this dawn becoming day was changing moment by moment. For now there was blue above, and the tall grass was streaked and blowing, the quail barked from their hidden nests. Why give up anything? Someone is always coming home, turning a final corner to behold the house that had grown huge in absence, now dull and shrunken, but the place where he had come of age, still dear and like no other. I have come home from being lost, home to a name I could accept, a face that saw all I saw and broke in a dark room against a wall that heard all my secrets and gave nothing back. Now he is home, the one I searched for. He is beside me as he always was, a light spirit that brings me luck and listens when I speak. The day is here, and it will last forever, or until the sun fails and the birds are once again hidden and moaning. But for now, the lost are found. The sun has cleared the trees, the wind risen, and we, father and child, hand in hand, the living and the dead, are entering the world. Finally, I feel I would be remiss with myself and with Philip Levine himself if I did not mention the shadow beneath which this event takes place this evening. I am confident that all of us, regardless of our particular convictions about the activities that are taking place in our name as Americans on the other side of the world, I am confident that all of us are experiencing many of the same emotions, anxiety, distress, sadness, and fear. There are many poets whose work I would not want to hear this evening, and not because they are not good poets, but because what they have to say is not what I need to hear. What I need to hear, especially tonight, are the poems of Philip Levine with their reverent regard for the autonomy and individuality of all human persons. Levine is a poet whose persona has often been described as anarchistic, defiant, enraged at social and political injustice. He has identified himself relentlessly with the disenfranchised, the oppressed, the spat upon. One of my colleagues at Vanderbilt University introduced him at a reading in 1995 by describing in great detail a struggling, impoverished, mentally disturbed woman who worked as a parking lot attendant at a Wendy's fast food restaurant in Nashville. And at the end of the introduction, at the end of this long description, said, "It is for this woman that Philip Levine writes his poems." Levine's extraordinary embrace of characters who have not historically been granted voice or subjectivity in literature is a large part of what makes him a truly great poet. It is this unprejudiced and non-judgmental embrace that forms the essential empathy that underlies all his work. Whether he is imagining a doomed creature on its way to the slaughterhouse, or speaking across time to the dead heroes of the Spanish Civil War, or remembering an actual person long deceased from his early life, the core of Levine's poetic persona is an intense, empathic identification with those who have not prospered in the eyes of the world. His accurately painful feel for the psychological and emotional realities of their lives binds him in our minds with another great American poet, Walt Whitman. On this evening, I cannot help but think of the words of Whitman, "My enemy is dead. A man divine as myself is dead." And I think of all the words of Philip Levine that I have read over the years that have explored just as empathically the relationship between self and others. These lines from his poem, "To My God in His Sickness," stick particularly in my mind tonight. "Can the hands rebuild the rocks? Can the tongue make air or water? Can the blood flow back into the twigs of the child? Can the clouds take back the deaths?" I am so grateful that on this evening, perhaps our last before war, we have the privilege of hearing Philip Levine read to us from his poetry. Please join me in welcoming him.
I want to thank Kate for that eloquent introduction that I could not hear backstage. I caught several words, Levine, but I know it was genuine. I want to thank the Lannan Foundation for bringing me here to these dizzying heights. That's why I'm sitting down. My wife always asks me, "Don't rant, Philip." When I read, there are other occasions where I rant. So I'm not going to rant about, you know, this new venture of my country. I've been watching so many idiotic and inhumane ventures, but this one sort of tops it. I always try to read a poem I didn't write. Not to confuse you and make you think I wrote it, but because it's possible. It's a long shot, but it's possible you won't like my work. And you ought to get something out of the evening, you know. So I bring a great poem. This is a poem you probably don't know because almost no one does. It's by a Welsh poet. It's a war poem from the Second World War. And I thought I'd read a powerful war poem. It's a poem about loss. It's about loss of outside the self and loss within the self. It's an extraordinarily subtle poem. It's by a poet named Alun Lewis, a man, an officer in the British Army who died in Burma in 1944 at age 28. He left behind in England a wife. He hadn't been married long, perhaps a year. They'd hoped to conceive a child. They failed. And the poem is partly about that. And it's largely about that, although... And the wife speaks. It's called Song on Seeing Dead Bodies Floating Off the Cape. He included that little epigraph. That was what sponsored the poem. He sailed from London, from Liverpool to Brazil and then all the way around the Cape to India and then to Burma. Song, and the wife speaks. Or thinks. You might say it's an internal monologue. The first month of his absence, I was numb and sick, and where he left his promised life did not turn or kick. The seed of love was sick. The second month, my eyes were sunk in the darkness of despair, and my bed was like a grave, and his ghost was lying there, and my heart was sick with care. The third month of his going, I thought I heard him say, "Our course deflected slightly on the 32nd day, the tempest blew his words away." And he was lost among the waves. His ship rolled helpless in the sea. The fourth month of his voyage, he shouted grievously, "Beloved, do not think of me." The flying fish, like kingfishers, skim the sea's bewildered crests. The whales blow steaming fountains. The seagulls have no nests where my lover sways and rests. We never thought to buy and sell this life that blooms or withers in the leaf. And I'll not stir so he sleeps well, though cell by cell the coral reef builds an eternity of grief. But oh, the drag and dullness of myself, the turning seasons wither in my head, all this slowness, all this hardness, the nearness that is waiting in my bed, the gradual self-effacement of the dead. His name is Eilun Lewis. I just learned how to pronounce his name. It's a Welsh name. And the book is Ha Ha Among the Trumpets, but it's not available in the United States. I don't think it's ever been printed here. This book is called Unselected Poems. I'd like to read a couple of poems from it. I love the title. It's mine. I mean, I invented it. My editor at Knopf, a wonderful man named Harry Ford, Oliver Shalom, he's gone now, hopefully to a better world. He hated the title. He wouldn't publish it under that title. And that pleased me, because I didn't want him to publish it, but I couldn't refuse it if he'd wanted it. So it was fun to have him turn it down. When I was a young guy, I went to New York to the 92nd Street Y to hear Dylan Thomas read. And it was a memorable evening for me, probably. Might have been for him, I don't know. It's probably a lot like a lot of evenings for him. You know, he looked terrible, and he tottered out to a podium, and he held on for dear life and read beautifully. And one of the things he said struck me very powerfully. He said that he sent his poems out and in envelopes, and these envelopes came back. And some got checks. And sometimes the poems themselves came back with their tails between their legs. And I thought, what a fantastic idea. He regards his poems as little creatures. And then about 25 years later, I was sitting at the breakfast table. My oldest son said to me, "Dad, how many poems would you say you have out there working for you?" And I had always thought of myself, you know, as the exploited. And suddenly, here I was. But I thought they do a good day's work. Rilke says of lovers, they do a great night's work, you know. Well, my poems aren't up there, you know. So I thought I'll collect them and I'll put them in a book. And these poems that had fallen off, you know, that weren't in any books. So I rescued them and put them in this book, and now I can hear them buzzing away, working their little asses off. Let me read one at least. I rarely read from this book, so, and these are forgotten poems. You know, denied, left out of the selected poems, and despised. It's called The Doctor of Starlight. I spent several hours today at one of your local hospital. I must say, I was treated pretty well. I mean, better to see a doctor in the hallway than not at all. That's now my motto. Who needs a room, right? I wasn't going to stay all night. All right. They did help me. They you know, prescribed a drug which I didn't take. I'm okay. All right, the doctor is startling. Show me the place. Show me the place, he said. I removed my shirt and pointed to a tiny star above my heart. He leaned and listened. I could feel his breath falling lightly, flattening the hairs on my chest. He turned me around, and his hands gently plied my shoulder blades and then rose to knead the twin columns forming my neck. You are an athlete? No, I said. I'm a working man. And you make, he said. I make the glare for light bulbs. Yes, he said. Where would we be without them? In the dark. I heard the starched dress of the nurse behind me, and then together they helped me lie face up on his table where, blind and helpless, I thought of all the men and women who had surrendered and how little good it had done them. The nurse took my right wrist in both of her strong hands, and I saw the doctor lean toward me, a tiny chrome knife glinting in one hand and tweezers in the other. I could feel nothing. And then he said proudly, I have it, and held up the perfect little blue star, no longer me and now bloodless. And do you know what we have under it? No, I said. Another perfect star. I closed my eyes, but the light still swam before me in a sea of golden fire. What does it mean? Mean, he said, dabbing the place with something cool and liquid, and all the lights were blinking on and off, or perhaps my eyes were opening and closing. Mean, he said, it could mean this is who you are. Yeah, I wrote that during the Reagan years when I couldn't figure out what I was. Am I an American? Can't be. I can talk, I can walk, I can think. I have a certain level of compassion. Not a lot, but some. I can't be like that man. I wear nice clothes, which I disdain. They pay the heating bill. I would like you to know that. I don't know. I loved writing poems that I assumed someday I would figure out, as I would figure out the career of my country. In truth, I didn't figure out either. I've been asked to read this poem, and I'm pleased to do so. It's called Starlight. It takes place, let me see, it would be about 1933 in Detroit. Could be 32. Starlight. My father stands in the warm evening on the porch of my first house. I am 4 years old and growing tired. I see his head among the stars, the glow of his cigarette redder than the summer moon riding low over the old neighborhood. We are alone, and he asks me if I'm happy. Are you happy? I cannot answer. I do not really understand the word, and the voice, my father's voice, is not his voice, but somehow thick and choked. A voice I have not heard before, but heard often since. He bends and passes a thumb beneath each of my eyes. The cigarette is gone, but I can smell the tiredness that hangs on his breath. He has found nothing, and he smiles and holds my head with both his hands. Then he lifts me to his shoulder, and now I too am there among the stars, as tall as he. Are you happy, I say? He nods in answer, yes, oh yes, oh yes. And in that new voice, he says nothing. holding my head tight against his head, his eyes closed up against the starlight, as though those tiny blinking eyes of light might find a tall, gaunt child, holding his child against the promises of autumn, until the boy slept, never to waken in that world again. Let me read a couple of poems you wouldn't have heard unless you've been poking about my house, which is highly unlikely. This, I guess, you could kind of... No, I'm not going to call this a war poem. There are references to war in it. There's a reference to Remagen, which was a famous bridgehead to cross the Rhine in World War II. It would have been Patton's army that created it and used it. And it took... my cousin died there before the war. Seeing his mother coming home, he kneels behind a parked car, one hand over his mouth to still his breathing. She passes, climbs the stairs, and again the street is his. We're in an American city, Toledo, sometime in the last century. Though it could be Buffalo or Flint, the places are the same except for the names. At 8 or 9, even at 11, kids are the same, without an identity, without a soul, things with bad teeth and bad clothes. We could give them names. We could name the mother Gertrude and give her a small office job typing bills of lading 8 hours a day, 5.5 days a week. We could give her dreams of marriage to the boss, who's already married. But we don't, because she loathes him. It's her son, Saul, she loves, the one still hiding with one knee down on the concrete, drawing the day's last heat. He's got feelings. Young as he is, he can feel heat, cold, pain, just as a dog would. And like a dog, he'll answer to his name. Go ahead, call him. Hey, Solly, Solly boy, come here. He doesn't bark. He doesn't sit. He doesn't beg or extend one paw in a gesture of submission. He accepts his whole name. Even as a kid, he stands and faces us, just as 11 years from now, he'll stand and face his death, flaming toward him on a bridgehead at Remagen, while Gertrude goes on typing mechanically into the falling winter night. Let me read another family poem, and then I'll move to some other things. Sometimes I like to write in traditional forms. We have a movement in America called neo-formalism, often retitled neo-boredom. And some poets thrive writing these poems. I mean, we do have some great formalist poets. They're all about 112. Richard Wilbur's a marvelous formless poet. Anthony Heck. There must be a third. but they're not kids. But anyway, I grew up writing formal poems because I thought that's what poetry was. In Detroit, you must write in forms. Henry Ford. He had a little poetry school. I'm going to read this. It's a kind of family poem, and it uses a lot of traditional, formal devices. A Packard 16, it was an automobile manufactured. It was actually a 16-cylinder car, 2 8-cylinder engines in a V configuration. I don't know if there are any other references that you wouldn't get. The genius, it's called. Oh, there's the word kike. which is a very unfriendly word, often addressed to Jews to mean they're garbage. And it was a word that seemed to have a lot of frequency, currency, in the Detroit of Henry Ford, the genius. When Jake gave up his job on afternoons, who took up his magical tools so the line would never stop? Think of the Packard 16s rolling and rolling toward paradise or Toledo without their upholstery perfected. Think of it in human terms, the want of a stitch, the want of a tuck. Lonnie, the foreman, howling, where's my kike when I need him? The heads of the sewers bowed before the cloth they'll puzzle over forevermore on earth or in heaven. Let the whole shop know he won't arrive. Jacob the cutter missed the streetcar this very afternoon, and no one cried out. We're short a passenger. The little kike whose bad left shoulder tilts to the right. No one noticed. Not even the conductor busy shortchanging and punching transfers, nor the blank assemblers, nor the typist, her scalded fingers the color of cinders. No doubt the God of Detroit looked down or up, however such a God might look, and found things as usual. Green, the sweet rivers of home, green as raw beer pissed out, and the air was lavender, and the little kike with a lilt to the right was nowhere in sight. All that afternoon, the men in upholstery did as they might, and nothing got done. The angels of Detroit, among the silent choirs of engineers, wept to see their industry unhouseled after so many profitable years. The answer is, no one took up the tools. No one took up the craft. The handmade awls, the cruel needles, scissors, knives, all he had sewn vanished with him at 4 p.m. This has been a short chapter in the tragedy of my country, one without beginning, middle, or end, as Aristotle wrote, such tales require, not having lived in Detroit. And yet among these details abides a truth that defines the nature of events on earth, the perfection of the life or of the work, and has nothing at all to do with Uncle Jake. Well, maybe I'll read something sentimental. Joke. Every year, my work winds up in an anthology called Best Religious Writing, which I welcome, because I secretly think of myself as religious. Though, if you were to ask anyone who knows me, they would say outrageous, you know. But this is, I think, the most religious poem I wrote since this anthology is coming out and published, and it didn't go in. It's called Houses in Order. You all know where the Williamsburg Bridge is. You know, it goes from Brooklyn to Manhattan. In New York, they would say it goes from Manhattan to Brooklyn, but we know otherwise. If you have to get over there, you know, take it. Houses in Order. In cardboard boxes under the Williamsburg Bridge, a congregation of mature rats founds a new order based on the oldest religious principles. They eat whatever they can get their teeth into. By day, they move slowly about their kingdom. Some day so slowly they seem for hours on end to become holy relics, or the stained brown backgrounds to events foretold in parables to do with the savor of salt, the mysteries of mustard seeds, meat, bones, loaves, and fishes. When you look back, they've gone into water or air. They've joined the falling rain that makes vision so difficult even for the visionary. The little houses keep their secrets the way windowless houses always do. though their walls and roofs proclaim the hour's holy names, Nike and Converse, Panasonic and Walkman. And though they let light leak in through their teeth-torn ports and darkness out from under their lids, they're closed to all but the eyes of the faithful. These dull pilgrims contemplate the business of gathering and hunting while the day hangs on and the traffic drones on the bridge above. Soon the headlights come on singly or in pairs. The rain gleams falling through the taut cables. No moon rises above the island where now they are among us, each one doing a morsel of God's work until their small jaws ache from so much prayer. Let me read a few poems from my last book. How are we doing? Oh! There's a little machine here that says, hurry up. Yeah, let me read one about working folks. Oh, I have a newer poem I like better. It's a little confusing. Though it was written during the Bush years. Here it is. It's about working folk. Again, Packard features the guy in the poem works at Packard. It was, you know, the car was very elegant, but the factory was just like all the rest, you know, a dump. I think that's the only reference. Linwood is a street in Detroit. It takes place in Detroit. Grand Boulevard is a Grand Boulevard in Detroit. Excuse me, Grand Boulevard was a Grand Boulevard in Detroit. Detroit was once a rather grand city, especially during World War II. The two. When he gets off work at Packard, they meet outside a diner on Grand Boulevard. He's tired, a bit depressed, and smelling the exhaustion on his own breath, he kisses her carefully on her left cheek. Early April, and the weather has not decided if this is spring, winter, or what. The two gaze upwards at the sky, which gives nothing away. The low clouds break here and there and let in tiny slices of a pure blue heaven. The day is like us, she thinks. It hasn't decided what to become. The traffic light at Linwood goes from red to green, and the trucks start up so that when he says, would you like to eat? She hears a jumble of words that means nothing, though spiced with things she cannot believe. Wooden Jew and lucky meat? He's been up late, she thinks. He's tired of the job, perhaps tired of their morning meetings. But then he bows from the waist and holds the door open for her to enter the diner, and the thick odor of bacon frying and new potatoes greets them both. And taking heart, she enters to peer through the thick cloud of tobacco smoke to see if their booth is available. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that there were no second acts in America. But he knew neither this man nor this woman, and no one else liked them, unless he stayed late at the office to test his famous one-liner, "We keep you clean in Muscatine," on the woman emptying his wastebasket. Fitzgerald never wrote with someone present, except for this woman in a gray uniform whose comings and goings went unnoticed, even on those December evenings she worked late while the snow fell silently on the windowsills and the new fluorescent lights blinked on and off. Get back to the two, you say, not who ordered poached eggs, who ordered only toast and coffee, who shared the bacon with the other. But what became of the two when this poem ended? Whose arms held whom? Who first said, I love you, and truly meant it? And who misunderstood the words so longed for, and yet still so unexpected, and began suddenly to scream and curse until the waitress asked them both to leave. The Packard plant closed years before I left Detroit. The diner was burned to the ground in 67, 2 years before my oldest son fled to Sweden to escape the American dream. And the lovers, you ask? I wrote nothing about lovers. Take a look. Clouds, trucks, traffic lights, a diner, work, a wooden shoe, East Moline, poached eggs, the perfume of frying bacon, the chaos of language, the spices of spent breath after 8 hours of night work. Can you hear all I feared and never dared to write? Why the two are more real than either you or me? Why I never returned to keep them in my life? How little I now mean to myself or anyone else? What any of this could mean? Where you found the patience to endure these truths and confusions? Oh, thank you. Thank you. Let me read. Sometimes I like to write something utterly sappy because I have, I have a sort of, I guess we all do, a kind of nonsensical nature. When I was young, I would never have let that into a poem. A joke and a poem? Well, I mean, one waited, and you didn't have to wait long for one's depression to arrive in a black package. And, you undid the ribbon and the string and opened it, and there it was, full-blown, a depression. Oh, boy, now I can write again, But, after a while, that got to, you say, geez, is that all there is to it? How about a little dancing? I mean, the things you actually live for, why don't you get them in your poem? This is called Philosophy Lesson, and the philosophy is dated because it's about me or my thing with philosophy when I was a college student, 50-some years ago. And hated an outfit called a group, a band, a pack, like of wolves, called the logical positivists, who went around, tearing the pages out of Aristotle's Poetics in the library. Or so my teacher told me, who was a neo-Kantian. Philosophy lesson. After driving all night long, I stopped for coffee and eggs at a diner halfway to New York City. The waitress behind the counter looked up from her magazine and said, "Look who's here," clapped her hands together and broke into a huge smile. "Have I been here before?" I asked. "Beats the shit out of me," she said, and put a glass of cloudy water in front of me. "What'll it be?" One war was closing down in Asia to be followed by another. No longer a kid, I wondered, who was I that a gray-haired woman up all night in a roadside hole would greet me like a star? "What do you think of Sartre and the existentialists?" I asked. "We get the eggs fresh from down the road. My old man bakes the bread and sweet rolls. It's all good." It's not often you get the perfect answer to such a profound question. On the way back to the truck, I listened to the pebbles crunching under my wingtips, watched two huge crows watching me from a sad maple, smelled the fishy air blowing in from Lake Erie, and thought, some things are too good to be true. Well, okay. Okay, let me. Oh, I know. The other day I read in San Antonio. And a guy read a poem of mine. One guy read a prose thing and another guy read some poems. They didn't tell me this was going to happen, which was, thank God. But actually, the guy read it very well. And I wondered, where the hell did he find it? Turned out I'd put it in this last book. But I'd never read it. I wrote it, you know, with all the passion I could summon, and then let it, you know, wilt. I'm going to read it. Probably not as well as he did, but I'll try. What is there? I don't think there's anything I have to explain. The Three Crows. Well, I should say that the main character in the poem is my great aunt Sippy, is the wife of Jake, who stumbled through the other poem. Guy who worked at Packard. The Three Crows. At dawn, my great aunt Sippy would rise and go to the east window of the apartment, face the weak October sun, and curse God. A deeply spiritual woman, she could roll strudel dough so fine even the blind could see through it. Overweight, 62, worn out from mothering three daughters and one husband, an upholsterer on nights at Dodge, Maine, she no longer walked on water or raised the recently dead. Instead, she convened at noon from her seven-story back porch with heaven's emissaries, three black crows perched in the top branches of the neighborhood's one remaining oak. Stuffed with strudel, safely inside the screen door, I heard her speak out in Ukrainian Yiddish, addressing the three angels by their names. They would flutter their greasy, savage wings in warning and settle back. Fuck with me, they seemed to say, you fuck with him on high. The hardness of eyes, the sureness of claws, the incessant caw-cawing of their voices, the incandescence of feathered wings, of gleaming beaks, all this she faced down. Who brought the sharp wheeze to her grandson's chest? Who left her youngest daughter simple? Who put Jake, her husband, crooked back and all on nights? For minutes on end, the three crows listened and gave nothing in return. I could say to all those who live in God's green kingdom, her grandson grew into a tall young man. Jake made it to days. Simple Annie, her daughter, learned to sew by hand at last. For in truth, all this happened. Even Yankel, her dearest brother, given up for lost 30 years before, escaped from prison in the pine forests of Siberia to make his way to Michigan. Can you hear the axe buried in a foreign tree, the child floating like ashes above the lost town? Can you hear the vanished world? I remember the three crows, especially their silences. I remember Sippy's voice, high and sweet, going out on her breath of milk and tea, asking to be heard. When the crows took off, I remember the high branches quivering before the world stilled. The three birds rose imperiously above the rooftops until they disappeared into a sky long ago gone gray about our lives, only to plummet surely back to earth. Thank you. I would like to close with the title poem of this last book, this most recent, not last book, Philip, what did you say? Gee, whew, that was a terrible slip. This recent book. The Mercy is the book, The Mercy is the poem. There's a library mentioned in it. It is the main library in Manhattan, of New York City. Main library on 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. The one with the lions out in front. The ship that took my mother to Ellis Island 83 years ago was named the Mercy. She remembers trying to eat a banana without first peeling it, and seeing her first orange in the hands of a young Scot, a seaman, who gave her a bite and wiped her mouth for her with a red bandana and taught her the word, orange, saying it patiently over and over. A long autumn voyage, the days darkening with the black waters calming as night came on, then nothing as far as her eyes could see in space without limit, rushing off to the corners of creation. She prayed in Russian and Yiddish to find her family in New York. Perhaps prayers unheard or misunderstood or ignored by all the powers that swept the waves of darkness before she woke, that kept the Mercy afloat while smallpox raged among the passengers and crew until the dead were buried at sea with strange prayers in a tongue she could not fathom. The Mercy, I read on the yellowing pages of a book I located in a windowless room of the library on 42nd Street, sat 31 days offshore in quarantine before the passengers disembarked. There a story ends. Other ships arrived. Tancred out of Glasgow, the Neptune registered as Danish, Umberto IV, the list goes on for pages. November gives way to winter. The sea pounds this alien shore. Italian miners from Piemonte dig under towns in western Pennsylvania only to rediscover the same nightmare they left at home. A 9-year-old girl travels all night by train with one suitcase and an orange. She learns that mercy is something you can eat again and again while the juice spills over your chin. You can wipe it away with the back of your hands, and you can never get enough. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you for the reading, Phil. I've heard you read many, many times. I've heard you read many times over the years, and it is always fresh and delightful in wonderful kinds of ways, so thank you. As I was preparing, getting ready to think about the kinds of questions I wanted to ask you tonight for the benefit of the audience and for my benefit as well, I read over the interviews that you've published, and I've decided you are the most interviewed poet in American poetry. So the And I was stunned by the ways in which interviewers consistently, persistently, annoyingly asked Phil the same questions over and over and over again.
And so he gave the same answer.
Interestingly, Phil, you didn't always give the same answer. Part of what makes them interesting to read. So I've been racking my brains for weeks trying to think of different sorts of things to ask you. I want to start partly because we are celebrating your 75th birthday at Vanderbilt next month. I wanted to start by asking you to say a few words about longevity. It's actually something you've had a lot to say about in previous interviews. A lot of poets don't experience the longevity that you're enjoying. Some few do, and even fewer get to the advanced age of 75 and continue to write well. You are continuing to write well and to write very strongly, and it's a wonderful gift to all of us. Yeats, of course, is a poet who did that. The amazing Stanley Kunitz is a poet who is continuing to do that at 97, 98 years old. But some of your favorite poets have led very truncated lives. I'm thinking, of course, of Keats. I'm thinking of John Berryman. You've commented on both of them in this regard. As a young man, you once said you realized, I'm going to outlive Keats by 50 years. And you have outlived him by more than 50 years at this point. You described John Berryman once as saying, he was not built to last, he said. But you are built to last. So I wonder if you'd talk about that.
Well, I'm from Detroit. It's curious. I mean, I should have been manufactured in Wolfsburg, where they made VW. But I don't know. I think a lot of it's luck. When I think of Keats, he had no control over such a short life, living in London. In the early 19th century, one of the most polluted places in the history of the world, developing tuberculosis for which there was no known cure. It killed two of his brothers. I think a lot of it's luck, and then a lot of it is, I think, the acknowledgement early on that I wasn't a genius. It stared me in the face. At 25, I was not writing as well as John Keats because I wasn't as gifted as he. I was dedicated, but I wasn't as gifted. I was pretty well educated, and if I wasn't well educated, I had time to educate myself. It was the 1950s. The country was going nowhere that it hadn't been before. Nobody gave a damn about poetry. So, there was a wonderful freedom to do what you wanted to do. There was the advantage of being unread, which gets old after a while. But I recognized that if I were going to be successful, it would take a while. I would have to structure my life more like Thomas Hardy than John Berryman. Mm-hmm. John was a friend. And it was painful to watch him destroy himself through alcohol and skirt chasing and things of that nature, to lead such a reckless and essentially stupid life. I cared about this art that gave me so much. So I just dug in.
I think that it makes me think of one of the other things that has always seemed interestingly unique to me about your life as an American male poet, and that is the ways in which the life you have lived has tended not to conform to, a lot of stereotypes that we carry as a culture about what a male writer, in particular a male poet, what kind of life he's supposed to put together for himself. I mean, you haven't gone off and lived in a sort of Hemingway-esque type of way. You haven't cultivated a kind of mano-a-mano, macho type persona in your personal life. Phil and I were speaking earlier today of a mutual friend, a poet who shall remain nameless, who likes to regale friends with tales of his knife-fighting days in Belgium. These things may appear in certain ways in your poetry, but they have not seemed to be part of your life. Essentially, you have lived for the last 50 years, I think, in a house with a wife and children, and have gone to your desk every day and written poems, and have gone to work and taught your classes. And it seems to me that now part of what you've just said is that was a very conscious decision for you, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, my first 20-some years were much more reckless. I drank a lot. I chased women unsuccessfully, but I tried. I tried to be, Lothario. I went to Cuba, drank rum.
Any knife fights in there?
Oh, no. Any rumors of knife fights? And I was holed up in my hotel room. I traveled around the United States. I was poor, not by choice. I remember I worked for a guy once who used to hire me to drive his car to certain places. He would say, I have a date in New York this weekend. Would you take my convertible? He had this huge Oldsmobile convertible. I can't bear driving it all the way there, but take it. And, you know, meet me at the hotel at so-and-so. And I would go. And one time I was driving him around, and he said, I know you're a smart guy, you have all this college education and everything, but you know, I'm really smart. I was born rich. And I don't know how I kept myself from, you know, parking and strangling him, you know. I mean, yeah.
You made him a character in a press piece.
I got him.
Yeah, I recall that.
Your mother, you know, I mean, what a schmuck.
Writing well is the best.
Yeah, revenge. Yes, writing well is the best. Like hell it is. Living well is the best. I've lived well. I married a beautiful woman. I have 3 children. I get along with a couple of them. I have wonderful grandchildren. I don't work, I teach. You know, so I mean, life has been pretty... I have some poems about jazz in which I talk about it as a great gift. I did nothing to earn this music. And that's the way I regard a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Jazz was a gift to me. I turned on the radio when I was about 16 years old, and this stuff came out. Holy cow, what is this crap? And I fell in love with it. Then bebop, which for me was the most beautiful expression of the post-war American consciousness, and it was a great cheat, mm-hmm. which I think... You know, one of the things about Berryman, there was an anger in him that he wasn't regarded as a kind of unofficial senator of the world, mm-hmm. you know, when he was sober. I never thought, when I bought poetry as a life, I knew nobody would regard me as anything but a poet. I was never going to write, I was never going to legislate as Shelley thought we ought to.
One of the things you didn't hear me talk about in my introduction, Phil couldn't hear me introducing him over here on the side of the stage, was I was talking about your empathy, the empathy in your work, your empathic identification with characters, and talking about that as something that underlies everything that holds your poems together. And when you're talking about sort of someone like Berryman's bitterness, you know, about not being regarded in the way that he wanted to be regarded, I think that points out what to me is one of the differences about your work. You have a much more Emersonian idea of the poet, that the poet is just a kind of regular Joe or Jane, like everyone else, who happens to have received this gift. And his or her responsibility as a citizen of the world is to use the gift in writing poems to express what is common to everyone. One of those gifts in your case seems to have been, you know me, I think, as a Phil and I have known each other for, I was stunned to realize, a quarter of a century now. And I think he knows me well enough to know that I'm an old baby boomer feminist, fairly unreconstructed baby boomer feminist. And one of the gifts in your work is a kind of very natural, very unselfconscious feminism. Rereading your work this time and reading all the interviews and the prose, I was interested to discover a lot of statements in which you talked about that. Not in a self-consciously identifying kind of way, but statements in which you talked about the equality of men and women and just a kind of natural assumption that characterizes your consciousness. And I'm very curious about where you think that comes from. You've begun to talk more in recent years about your mother and to put her in poems in different kinds of ways. I wonder if there's something early in life that dates from or how you were... Does it come from your wife?
Well, to be truthful, I don't know what you're talking about. I hope that's true. I hope what you say is true. I mean, but it is unconscious. I don't know what you're, as I say, I don't know what you're talking about. As an industrial worker in Detroit, I worked with women. Uh-huh. Often many more women than men. It was right at the end of the war, so there was a huge employment of women who had gotten factory work and continued to work in factories. And, I mean, there was no question that they were smarter, stronger, and more enduring than we were. It may have had, but there was a, and I received from them a great deal of kindness and thoughtfulness. And they didn't tend to play the kind of macho games that are night fighting knife fighting friend did, and that was a great surprise. There were women in my family whose courage and fortitude was very impressive to me, especially my great aunt Sippy was the. And a woman, a Greek woman, who lived next door to me, who I put in a poem that I haven't published yet. I thought those two women were the most extraordinary human beings I met before I was, say, 20 years old. I mean, they were just, there was something profoundly religious in their bearing, a kind of acceptance of the world that seemed beyond belief.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a number of female characters like that in your poems. You know, you read a poem tonight, really, about your aunt with the crows that has that same aspect to it.
But that it would turn me into a feminist. Don't tell my wife that. You're a feminist?
A few years ago, we sat together on a panel at, I can't remember where it was, somewhere in Washington, D.C. There were a number of poets on the panel.
Catholic and, University.
Oh, that's right. It was at Catholic University. That's right. And someone asked a question from the audience, you know, what is the use of poetry or why do we have poetry? And we all began answering. Part of my answer involved referring to work that I do occasionally in hospitals with poetry, working in a different sort of setting for poetry. And in the course of my answer, I talked about my own belief that although we do not write poetry for therapeutic reasons, we don't go to poetry instead of going to the psychotherapist, there is always some sort of therapeutic effect to be gained from writing poetry. And I don't know if you recall, but you and Yusef Komunyakov both immediately reached for the microphones in front of you and began to refute that answer. And as I was, so here I am in front of all these people, finally getting my revenge on you, Phil, for contradicting me in front of all those other people. But in the course of preparing for this, I came across a quotation of yours that put that response of yours in a new context. Someone had asked you in an interview within the last 10 years, what do you think you would have done if you hadn't written poetry and become a teacher of poetry? And you said, suicide. And then everyone started to laugh as this interview records it. But it reminds me that in your response on that panel that day in Catholic University, you talked about the fact that some of the most terrifying moments of your life had been experienced at your writing table writing. And I wondered if you'd talk about that.
No. I don't think I want to talk about it because I don't want to.
I don't mean specifically, but I mean I don't mean specific moments, the details, specific moments of terror, but the act of writing poetry as something that takes us into a place of terror. Rather than, you know, in the way that I think about it, a place that, however much it takes us into the place of terror, that I disregard that because of what happens on the other side of it. And I had the sense, and, you know, these however many years ago this was, in which we sat on this panel together, that you had a very different notion of it, or experience.
I think my attitude in large is similar to yours, that I do see it often as therapeutic, but there have been these other moments. And always, of course, always the traumatic moments are the ones that live most vividly with you. And there have been moments when I dug up material that I really had a very difficult time coping with, containing in the poem, being true to, and felt myself, in a way, almost shattered by it, that I couldn't contain it. Uh-huh. It was larger than my craft or my character, even. Mm-hmm. Larger than the two things that you need, craft and character, I think, to be a good poet. And there were times when I felt, I mean, I was learning my limits to such a degree that it was terrifying.
Mm-hmm. So not so much what we sort of talk so often about to students in creative writing, or in poetry writing anyway, that part of the courage that's needed to write poetry involves not being able to anticipate what is going to come up when we write, and finding that often what comes up when we write is something terrifying, not at all what we expected. So a different kind of fear. Yours seems to be more a sort of a fear related to the, you know, the identity of the self as a writer, that one is not up to the task, as you said.
Well, it's the material and the failure to deal with it as fully as I had hoped. I go back to the writing in spite of it. I'm not that scared when I'm never afraid until it happens. Oh shit! What did I get into this for? But then there's always an answer there, and the answer is to make a poem. Mm-hmm. I think a poem. Poems have given me, and painful poems too, have given me so much pleasure. Is sort of almost a weak word, but pleasure is the word I'll say. They've given me so much, just given me so much, that I figure I might get a terrific poem that will give me a lot and give readers a lot, and it's worth it. So there are times when I yearn for that terror, mm-hmm. You know,
that
I'm going to have this huge monster poem, yeah, instead of something for the New Yorker.
One of the ways that I've thought about poets whose work has achieved a larger dimension than that which is achieved by the work of most poets has to do with the ways in which certain poets seem to experience a very fortunate confluence of their personal realities and public, historical events that take place during their lives. Certainly a poet like Yeats would be someone who benefited from that, but also Whitman, Allen Ginsberg, Adrienne Rich, Muriel Rukeyser, people like that. And I wonder if you think of yourself that way. I mean, certainly, there are all kinds of historical dimensions to your poetry, but I wonder if you think of yourself as a poet blessed by a certain kind of confluence between your personal self and the events of the era during which you lived.
I really don't think so. I tell you, when I was young...
Can I interrupt you a second before? Another way of asking this question is, would you have still been Phil Levine the poet had you been born, say, 10 years earlier or 10 years later? That's sort of the question that I'm asking.
Probably. I mean, I think I would have... I don't know. Of course, I'm going to say yes. Yes, I would have been the poet. But I remember... when I was young, and I was reading Dostoevsky and Tolstoy especially, I thought of these two writers at a kind of critical moment in the history of their country, and the way the philosophical struggles in their novels are also historic struggles. Is Russia going to go this way? Is it going to go toward the West? Is it going to further embrace, the Orthodox Church? Will it find its values in Western humanist values, or will it remain this crazy kind of oligarchy that it was? And I thought, it must have been thrilling to be a writer at that moment in the history of the nation, the world, your people. And there was a kind of envy. But when the Vietnam War came along, and suddenly I was faced with a similar kind of opportunity, you can write, I didn't think it was so thrilling anymore. I thought it was appalling.
What did it feel like?
It felt terrible. Terrible. That is to say, day after day, you were faced with the notion that your country, which you loved, had embarked on a kind of savagery that disgusted you, and all of your efforts as a poet or as an individual, as a civic-minded person, were so tiny by comparison with the power of those who made these hideous decisions, just as I feel again I'm going to be faced with something very similar. It was an awful time, and I thought, gee, it was kind of pleasant back in Eisenhower's days to be writing poetry. Nobody was reading. You weren't going to get invited to the White House and then say, no, I don't want to go. A doctor today asked me why I refused to go to the White House for their tea party. And I said, they haven't earned American poetry, those jerks. They don't merit it. It's too glorious. Yeah. You know, a lot of us go around feeling we deserve the truth. You ask a question, do you love me? And you spoke, you think you're going to get the answer? You earn the truth. You earn the truth by showing you can accept it. And I think the same is true for poetry. You have to earn it. And it takes some character to earn it, and the character's lacking. Yeah, You accept your life. It's here. Let's do our best. You know, we'll endure. When I think about patriotism, for example, I'm always thunderstruck by, okay, it's the love of the country. And I think of the poet Edward Thomas, who went off in World War I and died for England. He was a very apolitical man. And before he went off, his beloved said to him, you know, Edward, why are you doing this? And he reached down and he picked up a handful of earth and he said, I love this England. I love it. He hated the government. He hated the war. But he said, I love this England. He loved the language. He loved the landscape. He loved the flowers. He loved the characters he met on his... He was a recluse on his rambles and everything. There was an England that he adored. And he went off and died for it. And when I think of what do I love about America, I love its language, I love its literature, I love its people, I love its landscape, I love its diversity, and I consistently have hated its government and its policies and its foreign vision, you know, its quest for empire, its oil barons, its pompous shitty newspapers, you know, television.
Well, speaking of newspapers, I'm going to ask you one last quick question. It's an odd question. It comes from an article that was in the New York Times magazine a couple of weeks ago about a young Jordanian man who is a computer programmer, quite talented at computer programming, who wanted to commit jihad against the United States. He absolutely hated the United States. At the same time that he was possessed of this desire to his fondest desire, his obsessive desire, you may have read this, was to move to the United States to Seattle to work for Microsoft. An incredible collision of, you know, sort of opposites contained within this one consciousness. And I'm wondering, for a poet like you, who is completely unplugged, right? You do not email or work on the internet or do anything like that. And whose poetry, he does have a television, I believe, so he's not totally, and whose poetry is so beautifully rooted in the specifics of a particular time, a particular place, a particular community, in a way that has always nurtured and created the greatest and the best poetry. I wonder what you think of when you imagine people like this young man, who are having experiences that feel very powerful and very genuine and very authentic, and yet they exist in some kind of cyberspace that has no kind of concrete reality whatsoever. I mean, the internet is a very disorienting experience. It is something that, when you, you know, submit yourself to it, makes you feel as if you're having a very powerful and very authentic experience, and you turn it off and you're still sitting in your office at your little desk. And you've been all literally, you know, imaginatively all the way over to the other side of the world. What kind of poetry can arise from the imaginations of people who, so many of us who are living that way?
I think the poetry we have. I mean, you just described me at my desk, traveling all over in my imagination.
Uh-huh.
And then I put the pen down, but I still have it in my head. I didn't have to pay anybody for it. I would like, though, you talked about this terrific conflict. I want to read just a little sentence here from a letter that this one, Alun Lewis, wrote his wife, one of his last letters to her. He was actually a pacifist, but he felt the threat to England was so great during the Battle of Britain that he enlisted in the army and of course died. And he says, I find myself quite unable to express at once the passion of love, the coldness of death, death is cold, and the fire that beats against resignation, acceptance. Acceptance seems so spiritless, protest so vain. In between the two, I live.
In the gap between the two.
Yeah, that's where we are.
As you yourself have lived. Thank you very much for your poems.
Thank you, Kate.
And for your conversation.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.